I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest Robert Costa and his writing partner Bob Woodward have written some headline-grabbing stories for the Washington Post in the last week. They reveal that 7 hours and 37 minutes are missing from former President Trump's White House phone logs during a key time on January 6, 2021, from late morning to early evening when a violent mob was attacking the U.S. Capitol. Last week, Costa and Woodward published 29 texts that Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, exchanged with Trump's White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, pressuring him to block the results of the 2020 election. Some of her texts repeated the extreme views espoused by QAnon followers and supporters of false and discredited allegations about the election. Ginny Thomas is known for her support of conservative causes and signed a letter critical of the House committee in investigating the events of January 6th. We asked Robert Costa to join us on Radio Times. He is CBS News chief election and campaign correspondent, co-author with Bob Woodward of a book that was published last fall called Peril, about Donald Trump. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about it, and he is back with us. Robert Costa, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's start with the phone logs. And according to the White House, then President Trump made no phone calls between 11:17 and 6:54 on January 6, 2021. What is the significance of this missing information?
Well, initially, the significance is that we know other calls did take place. It's publicly reported and confirmed that Trump spoke with, for example, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, a Republican, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, during that time period. But the official documents provided from the National Archives to the January 6th committee in the House, under a Supreme Court order following Trump's request to block those documents, only have these 11 pages of White House switchboard records and what's called the Presidential Daily Diary, which do show some new information, calls to Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani in the morning and night of January 6th, but there is this gap, 7 hours and 37 minutes long, during the most crucial times of the attack on the Capitol. And the question is, why does that gap exist? Why are there no logs in the National Archive documents, at least, about who Trump was speaking with? And this has become a vexing issue for the January 6th committee as it tries to finalize its investigation and ultimately write a report and hold public hearings.
There is some question about whether he used burner phones. He meaning former President Trump, is quoted as saying, "I have no idea what a burner phone is. To the best of my knowledge, I've never heard of them." But we see from John Bolton, who said he knows all about burner phones. What can you tell us about that, Robert Costa?
When Bob Woodward and I were finishing up our story on the White House records that we have found, we reached out to the former president's office, as any reporter would. And he sent back a statement for our story saying, "I've never heard of burner phones. I've never even used the term, heard the term." We put that in the story, appropriately so, as his statement in reaction to our reporting. Well, after the story was published, I got a call from former National Security Advisor to Trump, John Bolton. And Bolton told me, "This is not a credible statement." And I said, "Well, why isn't it credible?" He said, in discussions with Trump in the White House, they often discussed the phrase burner phones in the context of intelligence or other matters, and that Trump was well aware of what it meant, that it means avoiding scrutiny of calls by using personal disposable phones. And so Bolton was contesting Trump's statement that he somehow doesn't have any idea about these burner phones. What matters about these so-called burner phones, if they were used,
right,
and it's still an if, is that if there is this gap in the records, why does it take place? There's a suspicion inside the committee, based on their own investigation, that Trump may have used staffers' phones, personal phones, things that wouldn't necessarily be part of the government's record, and that's part of their investigation.
And I guess the question is, you know, where the committee goes with this information, and I guess the significance of it. I mean, it's interesting to think of the missing minutes going back to the Nixon administration. How do you think this compares, or do we know yet?
I couldn't have a better reporting partner than Bob Woodward, who famously with Carl Bernstein discovered the 18.5-minute gap in the White House tapes under Richard Nixon. Rosemary Woods, a name some of the older listeners, I'm sure, will recognize, was the assistant to Nixon who was responsible for the taping system. And there was this unexplainable gap during a critical period in the Watergate scandal where there was just no record of Nixon's tapes. And the question always was, well, why was there the gap? That was 18 and a half minutes long. This is 7 hours and 37 minutes. And the January 6th committee believes, based on our reporting, that it can piece together some of that period by using call record data that it finds from other people who are cooperating with the committee. If they share their phone records, they can maybe try to map out different calls to a Trump number or to a White House number. But it's more difficult if you don't have an official record to use as a guide.
Well, and I'm looking at some of your reporting here. So until 11:17, he talked with Steve Bannon. He talked with Rudy Giuliani. He talked with Jim Jordan. He talked to Giuliani again. He talked to William Bennett and others from there. And then into the evening, he talks with Pat Cipollone. He talks with Giuliani again. And I'm just sort of picking and there's Bannon again. So it's such a curious gap there.
It's very curious. And the reason this really matters, Marty, is it's a crime to obstruct the peaceful transfer of power. That is what Liz Cheney, the vice chair, Benny Thompson, the chair of the House committee, have repeatedly stated publicly as part of their focus, that if someone has the intent to disrupt a government process, let alone to try to defraud the United States, but if they just try to disrupt the government process, the transition of power, that is a crime in federal code. And so that is one crime that the January 6th committee is looking at as a possible crime to accuse Trump of if their evidence leads in that direction. And so that period is so critical to understanding, what was Trump doing? Was he acting with the intent to obstruct the peaceful transfer of power? And that's, if they can't piece that together, they can't really have a full clarity on whether they make a criminal recommendation to the Department of Justice or not.
Well, we know that this was a president who texted all the time. Was he texting during that time?
He wasn't a texter. He's not a texter. I've covered him for over 10 years. With respect, he's not. He's a phone user. He doesn't use email. He doesn't text message, from everything I can tell. No paper trail. It's always phone calls.
There were also stories about him ripping up documents and some person at the White House had to scotch tape them together. Is there a connection between that and this almost 8 hour gap?
It does raise the question about what was going on. Real quick, the way this all works is that a personal assistant to the president sits outside the Oval Office, and their responsibility by law, through what's called the Presidential Records Act, is to take a handwritten notation of any calls coming in and out of the Oval, any meetings, and then provide those notes to a non-political person called the White House diarist, who works with the National Archives, and put them in the Presidential Records. What we don't know here is, were there notes taken? And if there were notes taken, either why weren't they given to the diarist on January 6th? And if they were, whatever happened to them? Because certainly the committee doesn't have them. And that's what our story shows.
Well, let me talk about your other story. And this is these are the 29 texts between Ginni Thomas, as I mentioned, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. These are texts that she exchanged with Trump's then White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows. When did they begin?
They began in the post-election period. Based on our reporting, though, of course, they might have had a correspondence. But this is the text messages Meadows has shared with the January 6th committee, a trove of over 2,300 messages. And within those messages, the 2,320 that he has shared with the committee before he ceased cooperation, there are 29 text messages between Meadows and Thomas, 21 of them from Thomas, 8 of them from Meadows. There's a flurry of activity in November, then there's an unexplained drop-off of the documents, no text messages from December, and then there's one straight text message in mid-January after the insurrection at the Capitol. And these text messages from Meadows, based on our reporting, have really become a spine of the investigation for the January 6th committee, providing at least a limited roadmap about what was happening behind the scenes. And the text messages show, in a very emotionally charged way, that Ginni Thomas believed that Trump needed to have a controversial lawyer, Sidney Powell, be, quote, the lead in the face of the Trump legal effort. So while the Trump White House is pursuing a case possibly all the way to the Supreme Court, Trump's words were, let's go all the way to the Supreme Court, his chief of staff is communicating with the spouse of a justice. And at the same time, you have Meadows framing this in almost apocalyptic terms, saying that this is not just an election fight. He texts to Ginny Thomas. He says, this is a fight of good versus evil. Evil can never triumph until the King of Kings, a reference to God, comes in and saves the day.
Let me read another text, and this came from Ginny Thomas, and she says, this is really taking from some of these more extreme right-wing websites, and she says, Biden crime family and ballot fraud co-conspirators, elected officials, bureaucrats, social media censorship mongers, fake stream media reporters, etc., are being arrested and detained for ballot fraud right now and over coming days, and will be living in barges off Gitmo to face military tribunals for sedition. I mean, Robert, that is just outlandish and obviously wrong.
It also has echoes of something that was circulating at the time on websites associated with a conspiracy theory, QAnon.
Right.
This was a very popular. Some of the theories that Ginny Thomas is promoting in these text messages have direct links to QAnon, whether it's kind of reporters and others in barges off Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, or it's this other theory about watermarked ballots, that Trump somehow watermarked mail-in ballots so he could track fraud. There was a refrain in the QAnon community called, remember the water, watch the water. And this is all circulated in messages to the chief of staff of the United States.
In fact, let me quote what she says. I hope this is true. This is to Mark Meadows. Never heard of anything like this before or even a hint of it possible, question mark. Watermark ballots in over 12 states that have been part of a huge Trump and military white hat sting operation in 12 key battleground states. Robert, just to underscore what you just said there.
Yes, I mean, this is blatant conspiracy theories. There's no other way to say it. And none of this is true. The least is not supported by any evidence I've ever found or others have found that Trump watermarked ballots or somehow there was going to be some kind of tribunal for people who were against Trump. This is conspiracy theories. And it just kind of captures that post-election period where Trump is at his ultimate crisis moment, trying to hold on to power. And he's surrounding himself with people like Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani. He's talking to Steve Bannon twice on January 6th. Mm. We never knew that until we saw these records. This is the group around Trump as he tries to overturn an election and block the certification of Joe Biden in Congress on January 6th. And one thing I just keep realizing, talking with Woodward on this story and reporting it out, even after we finished our book, Peril, which came out in September.
Yeah.
We think we know some of the story, Marty. We found that John Eastman memo that outlines a blueprint for a coup in the view of many. But we still are learning more day by day about the extent, the multi-front effort of what was happening.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our guest, Robert Costa. And we also have law professor Stephen Gillers to talk about ethics in the high court. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Robert Costa about two stories he broke with Bob Woodward, the missing hours from the White House phone logs during the January 6th insurrection, and Ginny Thomas's text messages to Trump's chief of staff. Robert Costa, we have a couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. In one of these text messages, Ginny Thomas refers to her best friend. Who do we think she's referring to?
Well, I never like to guess as a reporter about who the best friend is, but it's clear that Ginny Thomas and Justice Thomas have both referred to each other in public statements as their best friend. So all I would like to have as a reporter is clarity. We've reached out to Ginny Thomas and Justice Thomas repeatedly for comment about whether the best friend was Justice Thomas, whether he was aware of these text messages with Mark Meadows as he was looking to hear cases before the Supreme Court on these sorts of issues, and we just haven't had any clarity. Republicans have backed Justice Thomas since this story published and said he always acted with integrity. And we're not doubting his integrity at all. All we would like is just some clarity about, was she communicating with Justice Thomas about any of these exchanges with Mark Meadows?
Well, here's another name. She also texted about outreach to Jared. Can we assume she's talking about Jared Kushner?
We'll see. Jared Kushner is set to appear this week before the January 6th committee. And he is someone who had a front row seat, if anyone did. It was a member of the family who was also on staff. And it'll be very interesting to see if he can paint a picture of her involvement, if any, in the White House's final days beyond these text messages.
And was he at the White House on January 6th?
He was not, which is kind of a twist of the story. He was traveling that day.
She also talks about release the Kraken. What does that refer to?
Oh, the Kraken. The Kraken is a mythical sea monster.
Yes.
There was a movie a few decades ago about this Kraken monster. But in this context, the Kraken is a right-wing reference to a coming revelation of voter fraud, a revelation, it should be noted, that never came. But this was a real spirited belief in quarters of the right wing in the final days of the Trump presidency that somehow Sidney Powell, this controversial lawyer working with Rudy Giuliani and others, would, quote, release the Kraken and save Trump's presidency.
What are these texts due to the investigation by the January 6th committee?
Well, they've obtained them.
Right.
And so they're providing a roadmap to what Mark Meadows was doing, who he was talking with in the final weeks after the election. And at least they have them. I mean, the problem for this committee is that so many people have refused to cooperate. Bannon, such a central figure, talking to Trump. Bannon's at the Willard War Room on January 5th, talking to Trump and Giuliani. Bannon has refused to comply with the subpoena, all the way to being indicted by the Department of Justice. We haven't seen an indictment of a refusal to cooperate with Congress before this since 1983. That's how rare it is for the Department of Justice to pursue this kind of thing against someone who refuses a congressional subpoena. Bannon will cooperate. So many people who come into the January 6th committee and, quote, cooperate, just plead the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, the text messages matter because it's hard evidence about what was going on.
Does it get closer to former President Trump?
Everything, in a way, kind of paints more of the picture. But we still have the 7 hour and 37 minute gap. And this is a person who had a very tight inner circle at the end, and many members of that tight inner circle, like Dan Scavino earlier this week, his social media director and confidant, who was everywhere. Dan Scavino refused to cooperate with the committee to the point the committee recommended criminal contempt charges.
Well, we got to leave it there. Robert Costa, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. CBS News chief election and campaign correspondent, author with Bob Woodward of Peril, that was published last year. Well, we've been talking about the 29 text messages between Ginni Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows following the 2020 presidential election. She was pressuring Meadows to overturn the results of the election and referenced a number of Stop the Steal conspiracy theories. These disturbing revelations about the direct communication between Thomas and the White House have raised serious questions about Justice Thomas's failure to recuse himself from election-related cases and judicial ethics at the highest court. We asked Stephen Gillers to join us. He's a professor at New York University Law School, where he writes on ethical rules that govern lawyers and judges. Stephen Gillers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Delighted to be here.
Well, very good to have you. We have a lot to talk about. Let's start with Ginni Thomas's activism. Is that out of line for a spouse of a Supreme Court justice?
Well, it's not out of line. She has First Amendment rights. She could be as active and vocal as she wants on the issues of the day without thereby forcing the recusal of her husband. It is unusual to have such a high-profile spouse of a justice in our constitutional history, but it's her right to speak her mind. And the fact that she does so doesn't necessarily mean that her husband is recused in cases raising issues that she has addressed.
Well, let me pick up on that. And she did reveal that she was at the rally on January 6th, and she left apparently because it was cold. So she did not storm the White House. But she was in not constant contact, but certainly contact with Meadows, basically pressuring him to if not overturn the results of the election, to challenge them, knowing that they could be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. I said storm the White House. I meant to say storm the U.S. Capitol. But nonetheless, do you see a difference between her attending the rally and then what she was texting with Meadows?
Right. I see a big difference. She did not merely promote her views on social media or in the blogosphere. She became part of the Trump team's effort to reverse Biden's win. She joined the club. She joined that effort. And that changes the calculus under the recusal rules. By becoming part of the effort, by choosing to write to Meadows, who would be influential in the strategy that the Trump team would adopt to overturn the results, a strategy that would include, and did include, as it turns out, appeals to the Supreme Court, she accepted an interest in litigation before the court that did require her husband to recuse himself. It's a difference between being a booster from the bleachers, mm-hmm. and actually going down into the dugout and helping to coach the team.
And I do want to get to Justice Thomas, but maybe I'm a little dense here. So if she had just attended the rally, you know, in support of the president, then President Trump, but had not written to Meadows, would we be talking about this? Would this be an issue?
It could be an issue for another reason, and that is that we now know that texts and possibly other communications from Virginia Thomas reflect critically on her in a way that she and her husband might prefer be kept secret. That is, decisions by the Supreme Court might unearth declarations, communications from Ginny Thomas, like the ones we now know about, right, that the Thomases would wish to keep private. And so for that reason itself, apart from her joining the Trump effort, her husband could not sit in cases that would lead to the disclosure of those communications.
Well, let me quote something, and this is about federal law on recusal. The law says that, quote, any justice, judge, or magistrate judge of the United States shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. Translate that for us, Stephen Gillers.
Right. Well, that's a statute. And as you quoted, it applies not only to lower federal court judges, but also to Supreme Court justices. And what it says is, if the underlying circumstances would cause a fair-minded, reasonable observer to have doubts about the justice's ability to rule impartially, then the justice is recused. It doesn't mean, this has to be stressed, it doesn't mean that the justice is actually biased or would actually be partial in his ruling. It means, however, that to the public, it appears that the justice could not be impartial. It's an appearance test, because we say that the appearance of justice is as important to the American legal system as the fact of justice itself.
Well, is this then a decision the justice would make, or would it be the chief justice of the court would say to Justice Thomas, and that, of course, would say, you know, I think you should recuse yourself on this one, or is it up to the justice himself?
Throughout our history, the court has left it to each individual justice to decide whether or not he or she is recused. And there is no review of that decision by the other justices. The law could change. There could be a way of adopting a procedure where the other justices review a decision of a justice not to recuse, but we've never done that. And so in this instance, each justice is the final arbiter of his or her own right to sit.
Well, and picking up on this, and of course, you and I were not privy to the discussion, but nonetheless, there was an emergency application from then-President Trump asking the court to block the release of White House records concerning the attack on the Capitol. The court rejected the request, I'm reading from the New York Times, in a sharp rebuke to the former president. Only Justice Thomas noted a dissent giving no reason. Does that raise questions for you?
Here's a situation in which disclosure of the records might have, based on what we now know, also disclosed the conduct and communications by Justice Thomas's wife. And therefore, Justice Thomas, in order to protect his wife, would have an interest in preventing disclosure. And not only his wife, but he himself might have an interest in preventing disclosure. So that's an actual case in which we now know he had an interest and she had an interest, and those interests could lead to a reasonable observer questioning Thomas's impartiality.
Do you question his impartiality on that case?
I do. I do, especially in light of the disclosures of the communications between Virginia Thomas and Mark Meadows. The disclosures tell us that there may well be, in fact, I think it's fair to say, there will likely be other examples of such communications that the court will be asked to allow or disallow disclosure of. Thomas has a personal and familial interest in preventing disclosure. Remember, the Meadows texts cover days in November and one day in January.
Right.
It is very hard to believe, it is doubtful, that that's all there is. And therefore, it is possible, more than possible, that further disclosures, which the Supreme Court will be asked to allow or prevent, will result in public awareness of other communications between Ginny Thomas and Meadows or other officials engaged in the effort to reverse Biden's victory.
And let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Now, Ginny Thomas, this is to you, Stephen Gillers. Ginny Thomas has said, my husband and I do not talk about politics or, here we go. This is what she told the Free Beacon Press. My husband and I don't talk about our work. So let's factor that. I mean, whether we believe her or not, how do we factor that into what Justice Thomas did or didn't do?
Well, do not talk about our work is certainly an ambiguous statement.
It sure is.
And doesn't cover the field. That's number one. And yes, it is difficult to credit that statement. However, Justice Thomas, as a member of the Supreme Court, charged with an obligation to recuse himself when the facts warrant it, cannot intentionally maintain a state of ignorance in order to avoid a recusal that would otherwise be required. The public will not believe any such claim. He cannot shut his ears to what is obvious. There is a saying in the law that intentional avoidance of knowledge is knowledge. Hmm. And so Justice Thomas had an affirmative obligation to learn what Virginia Thomas was doing, because that information might have and would have and should have led to his recusal.
Well, let me read a comment from Patty, who I think agrees with what you just said. She said, I find it impossible to believe, as Clarence and Ginny Thomas claim, that they do not discuss their political activities. They appear together at political events. They have said publicly that their relationship is as close to so that they are as one. And she talks about, as Robert Costa was saying, her best friend. I mean, you know, it's just... It beggars belief. What can I say?
You could say that it insults the intelligence of the public to claim that there is no communication between the Thomases about her work and her aspirations at all, and certainly in the days following Biden's victory.
Well, and because she, as our listener said there, she has been so active about it. It's not like she hasn't told the rest of the world what she's been doing.
Right. So for Justice Thomas to say, or for Virginia Thomas to suggest, that Justice Thomas can avoid recusal simply by not talking to his wife about what she does in the public arena is simply wrong. That, as I say, that insults the public. I don't believe it's true. I imagine many people don't believe it's true. But even if they actually try to create some kind of wall or screen between them and talk merely about other things in the news, but not politics at all, it is unacceptable for Justice Thomas to maintain that level of ignorance about his wife's activities. Basically, don't ask, don't tell is not a solution to the problem that the Thomas marriage presents to the court.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Stephen Gillers. He writes on ethical rules that govern lawyers and judges. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the fact that last week we learned about text messages between Ginny Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows about overturning the results of the 2020 presidential election. We're talking about ethics and the U.S. Supreme Court with law professor Stephen Gillers, talking about why Justice Thomas, in his belief, this would be our guest belief, should recuse himself because of his wife's activism, and why there should be stricter conflict of interest rules and recusal rules for the highest court. Stephen Gillers, professor at New York University Law School, where he writes on ethical rules that govern lawyers and judges. And you can join us. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stephen Gillers, I did want to read something else. This is how, I guess, the Supreme Court or judges and justices have to guide their judgment based on the activities of their spouse. Judges should not participate, the law says, in proceedings in which their spouse has, quote, an interest that could be substantially affected by the outcome of the proceeding. So if that's the law, how does that apply to Justice Thomas?
Right. Well, there are two reasons why Justice Thomas, under the statute, has to recuse from the election-related cases. And one is the language you quoted earlier. His impartiality may reasonably be questioned. But the other is that his wife had an interest in these cases and how they were decided that could be substantially affected by the ruling. And that interest arose because she was part of the Trump team's effort to reverse the election results. She wasn't just on the sidelines. She didn't write to her friends. She wrote to a government official, White House Chief of Staff, and possibly others we have yet to hear from. So she became part of the team. She chose to become part of the team that had as part of its strategy eventual appeals, which it filed,
right,
to the Supreme Court, including her husband. And that is her interest that is a separate basis for Clarence Thomas's need to recuse.
Well, let me play a couple of clips. The first one is Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. She was speaking this past Sunday on ABC's This Week, saying that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas should recuse himself for certain cases even after Jenee Thomas's text messages to the White House were revealed. Let's give it a listen.
The entire integrity of the court is on the line here. And they had better speak out on this, because you cannot have a justice hearing cases related to this election. And in fact, the ethics rules that apply to all the other federal judges say that if it involves a family member, appearance of impartiality, they have to recuse themselves. So not only should he recuse himself, but this Supreme Court badly needs ethics rules.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me play another clip. This is Republican lawmaker Ohio Senator Rob Portman on Sunday's Meet the Press, followed by Florida Senator Rick Scott on Fox News Sunday.
I don't know that he'll have the specific issue come before him about, you know, those records. That might be one where he would consider that. But look, he's a jurist who has a lot of integrity, and I think he will make that decision.
I admire and respect Clarence Thomas. I think he's been a great Supreme Court justice. And Clarence Thomas, in my opinion, will always do the right thing.
To you, Stephen Gillers, there is a case involving John Eastman, who is in many ways the sort of architect of what the Trump White House came up with to fight the results of the 2020 election. What should Justice Thomas do?
Right. Well, there's a lot packed into what you just played. But that particular case in California before a federal trial judge, David Carter, resulted in an opinion that in which Judge Carter said that the evidence that the January 6th committee had presented to him satisfied him that Eastman and Trump were more likely than not engaged in criminal activity in the events surrounding January 6th. The activity focused on two different criminal statutes. One, the obstruction of an official proceeding. And Judge Carter said that it was more likely than not that Trump participated in that crime. And the second crime was violation of a duty to fraud on the United States under a different statute. And the judge wrote that it is more likely than not that Trump and Eastman may have participated in that crime. Now, I consider this to be quite consequential, recognizing that this is a decision by one judge and that he's using a standard of proof of more likely than not. Nonetheless, this is the first time a judicial officer, a court, has come to such a dramatic conclusion. And that has to influence Merrick Garland as he considers whether or not indictments of Trump and members of his inner circle are required, because the test for bringing an indictment under the Justice Department's own guidelines, published in what is called the Justice Manual, which is a public document and can be found online, is very close to the test that Judge Carter used in finding the likelihood of two criminal acts. So, now, of course, Garland also has to recognize that to prove those crimes in a criminal court means he has to persuade 12 jurors, right, and he has to do it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a higher burden than Judge Carter had. But nonetheless, it is a decision that has to give Garland some serious reason to reflect on the wisdom of not charging criminal conduct.
Well, and criminal conduct, I mean, that those are two very powerful words. But I'm curious about, I mean, if or perhaps when this case makes it to the U.S. Supreme Court, Should Justice Thomas recuse himself because of the text messages that his wife sent to the White House?
Absolutely. In my view, for the reasons we've been discussing, Justice Thomas is recused from any case involving the election itself, any case involving the January 6th committee, and any case involving the insurrection at the Capitol. And he's recused from those cases for the two reasons we've identified. Those cases, as they play out, may disclose embarrassing private information about Virginia Thomas, and because Virginia Thomas has been part of the legal team through her effort to persuade and advise Mark Meadows that the Trump team is using to overturn the results of the election, and indeed to protect Trump's ability to run again in 2024.
Well, here's Karen, who says, my husband and I have been married for a long time. We differ politically on practically every issue there is. She says, I think it's insulting to think that Justice Thomas has to recuse himself from cases and that he would be so influenced by his wife. So that's a different from the previous email that I read to you. But she's saying, you know, he can be trusted to make a decision. I think we heard that from both Rob Portman and Rick Scott.
Okay, I'm glad you raised that, because the defenders of the Thomases try to redefine the issue this way. Is it true that a justice has to recuse whenever a case raises a question on which his or her spouse has taken a public position? And of course, the answer is it is not true. No one has said that. In the past, I have ardently supported the right of judicial spouses, including in print, Virginia Thomas by name, to be a public voice on issues that concern them without thereby forcing the recusal of their husbands or wives on the bench. That is not the issue here. The risk to Virginia Thomas is not that her preferred result may be rejected. The risk to Virginia Thomas is that, again, these cases may produce, as we already know the Meadows texts have revealed, private and embarrassing communications from Virginia Thomas. And second, she is part of the legal team. She worked with, advised Mark Meadows, who would be instrumental in fashioning the Trump team's strategy. So she didn't simply speak to the social media world, didn't simply become a booster of a particular result. She went inside to the group fashioning the response to the election. And that's quite different.
Well, let me throw another example out. This is a fictitious one, but let's say a spouse of a Supreme Court justice was on the board of NARAL and had gone to pro-choice rallies. We know, you know, an abortion case was argued before the Supreme Court. Would their spouse on the Supreme Court, would they have to recuse themselves? Or is that the leeway that spouses and justices get?
That's the leeway they get. In my view, the fact that the justice's spouse has been the public face on a particular issue, whether it's reproductive freedom or affirmative action or anything else, so long as they're not before the court, as through an amicus brief before the justice or part of the litigation team, they can do all of that without forcing the recusal of the justice. I want to be very clear about that.
Sure.
The orbit of freedom afforded the spouse of a justice is very broad. Virginia Thomas went further for the reasons I've identified, and only because she crossed those lines is Clarence Thomas recused from the cases I identified.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Gillers, and again, professor at New York University Law School, where he writes on ethical rules that govern lawyers and judges. And we have been talking about the text messages between Ginni Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows about the 2020 election. She was pressuring Meadows to overturn the results of that election. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I'm Artie Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Stephen Gillers, where does this leave Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who cares, you know, so deeply about the reputation of the court?
Right. It leaves Justice Roberts with a big headache. And I'm sure he is very worried about the declining reputation of the court among the public. He's got a real problem because, really, while he can go and talk privately to Justice Thomas and urge him to recuse in certain cases, he has no power, no real power to make it happen, and therefore has to accept that Justice Thomas's decision rejecting recusal will be final, regardless of the effect on the institution. Roberts is an institutionalist. That's good. He wants to protect the credibility of the court, but Thomas's behavior is seriously harming that reputation.
And we're almost out of time here. Is this an argument then that the court needs to come up with more better crafted rules when it comes to things like recusal and neutrality and impartiality?
Okay, well, here's my particular view on that, because I've thought a lot about this. The Supreme Court has been sitting since 1790, all right? 230 years. We've never had this problem before. We've never had this problem because spouses and relatives of justices exercise a high degree of self-restraint. Not because they have to, but because they choose to protect the court. Justice Ginsburg's wife, Marty, changed his job when she went to the court, as have other spouses of justices. So my view is that this is a terrible situation, but we have to live through it. Virginia Thomas is not worth changing the rules for. Eventually, Clarence Thomas will be off the court, and Virginia Thomas will have no ability to attract publicity. She'll resume being a fringe player at best. Her example is unfortunate, but for 230 years, we lived with good behavior by spouses of justices, and we will again when the Thomases are gone.
Well, I do appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about and talk about. Stephen Gillers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a professor at New York University Law School, where he writes on ethical rules that govern lawyers and judges. Well, to replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org, look for Radio Times under programs, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.